Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. This week, Noach. Welcome back from the season of the holidays. And now we're ready for every week another edition of Pardes from Jerusalem. Also, check out our electronic learning site. That's elmad.pardes.org for a full suite of electronic learning resources for Judaism. There's many different types of resources available there, both printed, written, and some videos too. So please check it out, elmad.pardes.org. Thanks very much. This week, Noach with Rabbi Dr. Mish Hammer Kassoy. Rabbi Mish Hammer Kassoy is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as a Pardes Director of Admissions. And now, Rabbi Mish Hammer Kassoy.
Thank you. How do you balance the need for intimacy, privacy, and self-protection with helping those in need and building broad relationships beyond your community? Exactly this is what is at stake in Genesis 6, verse 16, when Noach is famously commanded, Tzohar ta'aseh l'teva, make a tzohar in the ark. I'm afraid it's a hapax legomenon, meaning it's a word that only appears once in the Torah. So it's a difficult to translate that word. Of course, JPS doesn't have any trouble. Well, they're forced to make a decision, and they translated an opening for daylight, i.e. a window. But Rabbi Yochanan says something different. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Blessed Holy One, says to Noach, set precious stones and jewels in the ark so that they will shine for you as the afternoon, Saharaim, as the afternoon sun, Saharaim. Well, now that is a fantastical interpretation, right? And that would certainly explain why it only occurs once in the Torah, because only once is there an ark that has a sort of magic, shiny stone, which provides light as bright as a fluorescent afternoon sun. Interestingly, Rashi cites them both as if to say, I couldn't decide which one was the simple reading. Really? Rashi didn't know which one was the simple reading? I find that a bit tough to get my head around. On the one hand, you have to love this colorful sci-fi explanation. I mean, I guess maybe for us with electric lights, it's not that far-fetched. But for back then, is it not obvious that fresh air and light are needed in an ark? Why does Rabbi Yochanan shun what would seem to be a very simple explanation? What advantage does a miraculous, precious stone have over a simple window? Now, I'd like to answer that question by looking at another Talmudic disagreement that also occurs in our chapter. With respect to the verse just a few earlier before, Noach ish tzadik tamim haya b'dor tzav, etz Elokim hitzalech Noach. These are the generations of Noach. Noach was a righteous man and wholehearted in his generation. And it's exactly that word, bedorotav, in his generation that really gets the rabbis confused. Rabbi Yochanan says, relative to other people of his generation, he was righteous and wholehearted, but not relative to those of other generations. And Reish Lakish says, in his generation, he was righteous and wholehearted. All the more so would he have been considered righteous and wholehearted in other generations. While Rabbi Yochanan reads the specification in his generation as a but only, right? Compared, he was only righteous in his generation. In another generation, compared to Avram, he was really nothing special. If you're not, then you should be wondering, what the heck? What more could you want than being tzaddik tamim, right? To be righteous and what? Et Elokim, Hitzalech Noach, he walked with God. What more do you want him to do that he didn't accomplish? Rabbi Yochanan belongs to a school of thought that criticizes Noach for being what they call a tzaddik in a fur coat. We've spoken before about what makes Avraham great. In Bereshit Yudchet, in the 18th chapter, it says, Ki yedativ laman asher yitzaveh banav et beito acharav, v'shamru derech Hashem la'asot tzedaka u'mishpat. God selects him out because he will command his children and his household after him to keep the law, the way of God, and do justice and righteousness. So Avraham, he doesn't just follow the ways of God to do justice and righteousness. to do justice and righteousness. He actually yitzaveh et banav ve'et beito acharav. What makes him great is that he commands his household. He makes others do it as well, do that same thing as well. And Noach is just not that type. Noach is told to make an ark, and he does so. The text doesn't mention that he was standing on street corners and soapboxes trying to get people repent. God wanted to get up. God wanted him, but wanted him, according to this school of thought, to get up in God's face and protest. How can you work so hard on the world and then destroy it? God, how can you punish animals for sins that they didn't commit? God, try to make them change their ways. Noach himself was righteous. He did all the right things. He had an intimate relationship. He walked with God. But unlike Abraham, Noach saved himself with his personal behavior and also by building an ark, metaphorical fur coats, without bringing redemption to the rest of humankind. Thus, his righteousness is only relative. He should have done a little bit more to influence his community and help them feel the warmth of Torah. Instead of building a little fire to keep everyone warm, he put on his metaphorical fur coat, built an ark, and floated away with the attitude, "Not my problem." All that is according to the school of Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish, on the other hand, reads the word bedorotav in his generation with the modifier even, and judges Noach by the exact opposite standard. With friends like that, it's amazing that Noach managed to stay out of trouble. Isn't it a testament to Noach that his community did not bring him down? Social creatures as we are, very naturally influenced by our peers and our surroundings, everyone is doing it. How could he not do it? For that matter, in my mind, even to just distinguish right from wrong is no small task. When everyone around you is doing something, it seems to you appropriate. We observe and decide what's right and wrong from the culture around us. Statistics show it's really hard to stay out of trouble when living in a crime-ridden neighborhood. Even obesity is firmly connected to communal surroundings. How much the more so is that true of ethical standards? How can you possibly effectively repair the world when everyone around you is working against you? So Noach is amazing that he manages to hold himself to a high ethical standard, to be a tzaddik tamim. It's unbelievable that you can do that bidoratav in his generation when everyone's messing it up. Jewish tradition tries to make it a lot easier for us than it was for poor Noach. Judaism is so deliberate about the way it builds community, requiring minyan for so many important rituals, requiring that we keep kashrut in order to force us to eat with people who share our value system. We need to make sure that we have a community around us which will help us fulfill our potential as human beings. But for Reish Lakish, Noach didn't have that option. So he was the ultimate tzaddik. In the face of difficult surroundings, rather than be corrupted, it's better to create a personal refuge and to withdraw. And the fact that Noach managed to keep his own personal refuge makes him an unbelievable tzaddik. Okay. So having laid out this agreement about whether and how Noach should interact with his environment, it's a lot easier for us to turn to our opening question. What is the tzohar? A window is not just a way to get light and fresh air. It's actually a symbol of our deep connection to the world around us, our willingness to impact and contribute, but also an openness to be vulnerable to outside influences. In Genesis 7, V'yavo Noach uvanav ishto nasheh vanav ito el teva mipnei mei hamavul, that Noach went into the ark, him and his sons and his wives and the wives of his sons, together with him into the ark because of the water. And Rashi says, Anashim levad v'nashim levad, men and women separate, l'fishenes ru b'tashmishimita mipnesha olam sharui b'tzar, because the world, it was prohibited to have marital relations when the world was suffering. This is not a precedent for separate seating on the bus, my friends. This is about being connected, identifying with what's happening in the world around us. Yes, God saved Noach and his family. They have been selected and metaphorically crowned to take over and rule the New World Order. But this is no time for fun and games or even triumphalism. Suffering is suffering, says God. We need to empathize with it, even when it is a divine decree. Even though they're getting their just deserves, their suffering is suffering, and we cannot be happy while people around us are suffering. A window can also be a way of being connected to what's happening out there. With the help of a gem, it might be possible to generate light internally, but a window's better. This way, the light penetrates back and forth. We can influence them, and we can feel what's going on for them. So what then? Well, it was the power of the far-fetched gem interpretation. It was dangerous enough in the world with just the immorality that reigned before the storm. In a storm, you need protection. A basement with one of those heavy shelter doors would be appropriate, a refuge, a sanctuary, a shelter demanding a turning inwards. I get that, but I think there's actually a little bit more to it as well. And for that, I'd like to turn to another model, another set of windows, compare our window of the Tzohar to the window in Solomon's temple, a different kind of sanctuary. There, the windows of the temple are actually the very first feature described, even before the walls and the doors. They're described with a pretty strange expression. It says, "Vayas levait chalune shkufim atumim." He made window. This is Shlomo HaMelech, the King Solomon, made windows for the house, shkufim atumim. I don't want to translate those words, but as the commentators point out, it seems to be an oxymoron. Shkuf means, right, to look through, to open vision, whereas atum means closed. So they're closed open windows. The expression is very elusive. But its simple meaning is probably a window which combines both of these features. Either it's got lattice or glass or shutters, something that's both open and closed. But I'm not sure that is actually enough to hold your attention while you're driving or cooking for Shabbat. So I want to offer up the Midrash, which offers a bit more color than maybe it'll keep your attention. Rabbi Hanina said, "There were windows in the temple, and from then light would disperse to the world. What is the reason? He made for the house windows that were," and here he translates it, "broad and narrow, both broad and narrow. They got smaller within and broader on the exterior in order to disperse light to the world." The windows, normal windows, says the Gemara, are wider on the inside so that the light that comes from the outside can disperse and completely brighten up the room. But in this case, in the case of the temple, the windows actually went in the other direction. And the Gemara in Menachot adds, "Ki lo oro ani tzarich," does God need light from the windows? It's a symbolic way of declaring, we're going to have windows, but the windows are not to serve the inside, not to serve the building, but the opposite. The windows are to serve the world at large. The window symbolizes not only a sensitivity to what transpires in the world around it, but also a commitment to impacting it, to bringing the light from within out to the world at large. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah. The power of the temple is emanating out and bringing light to the world. And this light that the temple projects outwards recalls Noah's duty to bring salvation to those around him and suggests maybe that the windows in the ark also had that. Not only were they for us, for Noah, to be aware of the pain that's in the world, but also perhaps to bring a little bit of light and impact the world as a whole. I could say Dayenu, enough. The commandment to build a window is about connection, not being a tzaddik in a fur coat, about commiserating with the world in a time of trouble. And yet we have this other pull, to avoid being influenced by the wickedness around us, the attraction to build an idyllic, insular community when the world is on fire, and to make sure that we stay safe inside. And perhaps not surprisingly, we find this in the temple as well. Interestingly, while the windows of the temple reflect connection, openness, and obligation towards the world, in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, it was just the opposite. This is what the Yerushalmi Yoma says. It says, before the ark was taken, the high priest would enter and exit by the light of the ark. And once it was taken, he would grope his way in and grope his way out. Migashesh v'nichnas, migashesh v'yotze. So what the Torah is saying here, what the Gemara in Yoma is saying is that the Kodesh HaKodeshim didn't have any windows at all. It was totally dark in there. And there was a source of light, and that source of light was the Aron Kodesh. Wow. Not only is there a powerful juxtaposition in the wind, in the emphasis, both on windows, in both the both in the ark, the teva, and in the temple, but that but it's hard not to be struck by the parallel between the ark's magical light from a precious stone, the double use of the ark is difficult, right? The Noach's ark had a magical light from a precious stone, and there was also a magical light in the ark of the Kodesh Kodeshim. And if in the case of the ark, our first inclination was to see closeness in Noah's ark, our first inclination was to see closeness and insularity as a way of taking refuge and shelter from the storm. From the temple model, it now becomes clear that the insular character of the holy is not about that at all. Rather, it's about intimacy. Where would windows be less appropriate than in what symbolically seems to be God's bedroom? Above the glowing Aron sat the Kruvim, the cherubs, about which it is said that when the relations between God and Bnei Israel were strong, they turned face to face to one another and interlocked as lovers. So while the windows of the temple symbolize a duty to openness, to turn outwards, to serve the world at large, the insularity of the Kodesh HaKodeshim symbolizes the seduction of intimacy and chosenness, of privacy and of tremendous love between Am Yisrael and God that isn't to be shared with the rest of the world. Once we observe these values in the temple, then we can see their relevance with respect to Noah's Ark as well. So to summarize, we've got two cases in which the Torah seems to call for unconventional windows, a tzohar and shkufim atumim. Two understandings, and we've got two understandings of the tzohar in Noah's teva, which are parallel to the emphasis on both windows and insularity in Shlomo's mikdash. These represent tension between two poles, two inspiring but contradictory truths that we experience in our lives. We don't want to be a tzaddik in a fur coat. We want windows so that we can build connections with, commiserate, learn from, and shine light on the world around us. But we also appreciate the power of insularity and intimacy, of finding sanctuary in a unique relationship with God that protects both Noah and Am Yisrael from dangers of the storm. It allows us to grow in ways that only special love and attention and an exclusive community can facilitate. Whoa. In my mind, this has so much relevance to the way we live our lives every day. And I have to leave it to you to draw connections between these different ideas. I hope you'll do so at the Shabbos table. I hope that you will invoke Robert Putnam's fascinating book called Our Kids, which documents the disastrous economic segregation in contemporary America, the way that the rich and the poor have ceased living in communities with poor people so that the poor people find themselves isolated and vulnerable in ways that they were not vulnerable before. But I hope that you'll also think about the dangerous poles that we seem to be embracing in the American and Israeli Jewish communities around insularity and openness. It seems to me so clear that each camp, the American Jewish community and the Israeli Jewish community, could really benefit from opening windows to one another and really thinking about where we stand on insularity and on openness. So if you manage to raise this for discussion at your Shabbos table, I would love to hear from you by email. Let me know what comes of it. Ironically, even though Rabbi Yochanan criticized Noach for being a relative tzaddik. Rabbi Yochanan is also credited with being the author of the seemingly contradictory midrash that portrays God as commanding Noach to isolate himself without windows, but with the protection of the precious stone, the miraculous private light which symbolized divine love and chosenness. I love this tension. It seems to me that we should understand this apparent contradiction as an insistence that we live our lives in the mode of yes and, rather than either or. That is to say, the absolute tzaddikim protest on the street and beg their fellow citizens to change their ways. Yes, and when they fail, they too must show that they know when to take refuge. Conversely, Reish Lakish's school of thought demands that even when we find sanctuary, one should not be without a window so as not to turn a blind eye to the pain of the world around us. May we have the wisdom and conviction to balance the important values of intimacy, of self-protection, of helping those in need, and of building beautiful relations. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hammer Kosoy. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.